Barney and the JAP group for helping us bring such an important lecture to our community. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce Rabbi Kahn, a graduate of YU, made Aliyah to Eretz Israel 30 years ago. He's a rabbi in a community in Givat Ze'ev near Jerusalem, and a professor at Bar-Ilan University. And I can see here some of his students and the people that he has influenced over the wonderful career that he has had. We're very happy to hear Rabbi Kahn, who is a... Okay. I say here, not see him. We're going to... Very pleasure to hear Rabbi Kahn, who is published and written a great deal about and lecture on the issue of... And, Tanakh, as he said, from the view with the eyes of Chazal. A great pleasure for me to introduce Rabbi Ari Kahn.
Very indirectly. Why?
Because I'm close with the director.
Ah, okay. So I don't know who the director is. Otherwise, I would be close with him. Okay, so first of all, thank you to Rabbi Elgazi. Thank you to Barney for assuring that I would come here tonight. Generally, when I travel, even things like this are booked far, 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 far in advance. And Barney heard I was coming in for a wedding, and he grabbed me. He said, "That's it. You're coming. You're speaking." And I see it as a big advantage, because if we're here and learning, then my wife can't be shopping. So I'm very pleased to be here. Okay. So I'm a little bit of a disadvantage because I don't know almost any of you. So I'm really very troubled regarding what kind of level I should be speaking on. So you'll tell me if something I say doesn't make any sense. If you want the level higher, if you want the level lower, you're going to have to give me some instructions over here. If I say a word or a phrase or say something you don't understand, then please ask me. So the title itself, as far as what it was that we were thinking of or trying to get to, was something to do with Purim and Yom Kippur and Esther, and I think we threw in, I don't remember what else. What else did we throw in? Yom Kippur and anything else? Did we throw in feminism, postmodernism? I mean, we could use any of those terms. I mean, postmodernism is my favorite right now, because I've come to the conclusion no one knows what it means, and you can just say that about anything and say, well, this is basically a postmodern approach. I guess you say it if you don't want anyone to understand what you're saying. You say, well, this is really a postmodern approach. So I think that's what we'll be doing tonight. We'll certainly have a postmodern approach. But I actually advertise it now, I remember, as an ancient postmodern approach. And that's something which I do want to get to. So let's start. And the rabbi before asked me what it is that I do, which is a very difficult question because I'm not sure what it is that I do. And again, I don't listen to my classes, so I'm not sure what I said. As much as some other people. You can ask Barney what I do. I don't know exactly what it is, but what I want to try to do a little bit today is to understand some of the concepts, and you're going to see very quickly. So let's start. Okay, all of us know that there's a day of the year which is called Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is arguably the most important day on the calendar. Yom Kippur is what's called the holy, the high holy days, or one of the high holy days, but that really seems to be... The real apex of Jewish celebration, or perhaps celebration is the wrong word, but of the Jewish calendar. And there are certain Jews, I remember when I was growing up in Brooklyn, that there are certain Jews who would call them three-day-a-year Jews. They would come for 2 days Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. That's the days they come to shul. And I always thought that that's an unbelievably unfortunate concept for people. If they're going to pick 3 days, they probably have a real negative view of Judaism just seeing Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I mean, the Rosh Hashanah, the rabbis talk too much, right? And Yom Kippur, I mean, just imagine the same people coming Simchas Torah Purim, and do we have a third day? We don't have a third positive day. Okay, maybe over Hanukkah. I mean, you'd probably get somewhat of a different perspective. So I want to go back and try to understand what Yom Kippur is, what Purim is, how they're connected, and we're going to see some things along the way. So let's begin at the beginning. The Jews leave Egypt. I mean, when I say the beginning, I mean, I could go back to Abraham, but that's the beginning. The Jews leave Egypt. On the way out of Egypt, they see the most unbelievable things. They see the first of all, the 10 plagues, and they see the splitting of the sea, and there is manna coming from heaven, and everything is completely miraculous. Finally, the heavens open up, and they experience Mount Sinai, they experience the revelation, and their response to the revelation is fascinating, because the response is, this is too intense, we just can't take this. And they sort of recoil, they back up, and they ask Moshe to plead and let him speak instead of God, and they say, and they don't seem to be exaggerating, they said, if God keeps on speaking, we're going to die, we're just going to drop dead, we can't possibly take this anymore. Right there, by the way, right there, something went terribly wrong. Which means when God is speaking to you, the proper thing to do is to embrace it, is to accept it, is to listen to it, and hopefully to be transformed by it. And Moshe says this to them. Moshe says that if you listen to the word of God, you're going to be transformed. You're going to be elevated. You're going to get to a situation that sin will become an absurdity. But instead, they prefer not to. And I do want to explain exactly what happened here. God said, he started to say the Ten Commandments. According to the commentaries, and this is especially in the mystical tradition, Rashi cites this as well, that God said all 10 commandments simultaneously. He said all 10 commandments at once. Now, when you say 10 things at once, nobody can understand anything. Which means when he said all 10 commandments at once, it was just this overwhelming sound. Then God was going to break it down into individual pieces and explain to them each point. The people didn't even hear the sound. It says they saw the sound. They see the big picture of Judaism, everything at once. And God was going to break it down into details. That's where they backed off. And I want to just observe that there are still Jews today that love the big picture of Judaism, but they don't love the details. By the way, on the other hand, there are Jews who love the details, but sometimes lose sight of the big picture. And our challenge, of course, is to accept the big picture and to do each one of the details, realizing that this is the way to really create, you know, that beautiful mosaic. They moved away. Moshe alone goes up. And when Moshe goes up, something goes terribly wrong. And I do want to add something. Again, I think all of us know that when Moshe comes down, he tarries. He doesn't come down immediately. It takes a little bit of time. And the people start to get agitated. And when people get agitated, they turn to Aaron and they make requests. So I'm going to hold on right now. I don't know if any of you have ever... You all know everything I've said till now, right? Yes. So have you ever thought about this, that Moshe added a day in terms of the preparation? And when Moshe added a day in the preparation, is it possible that that then impacted on the counting on how long he was going to be around and how long he was going to be up? Which means over here we have what we can call a rabbinic law was created. We have Torah law, rabbinic law. Part of the partnership with God is that we do make rabbinic laws as well. But when this rabbinic law was made, it actually had some very difficult consequences to that. Oh, by the way, it's not the first time. All the way years ago, by as far back as you can go, the Garden of Eden, apparently there Adam as well made a rabbinic law. God said not to eat from the tree, and Adam said to Eve, don't even touch the tree. Went and she touched the tree, nothing happened. And again, the rabbinic sources speak about this. By the way, the key is that rabbinic laws are very, very good. Rabbinic laws protect the Torah. Rabbinic laws do more than that. Rabbinic laws are wonderful in situations where the letter of the law may be kept, but the spirit of the law is trampled. You hear that, what I said? Where the letter of the law is kept and the spirit of the law is trampled. I'll give you an example. I think that the most successful rabbinic law which ever existed was the rabbinic law made up by a rabbi who lived over 2,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago. His name was Isaiah, Yeshayahu HaNavi. Isaiah made up a rabbinic law that you shouldn't have your stores open on Shabbat. You could theoretically keep all 39 laws of Shabbat and have your store open. He said, you know what? If you have your store open, you may be keeping the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law is going to be trampled upon, and that's something which obviously is not acceptable. So consequently, he made up a rabbinic law. But what's the point? Rabbinic laws are good, but you have to say, the Torah law says this, and the rabbinic law says this. You're not allowed to add to the Torah. We're not allowed to add and say God said something that God didn't say. But you can, and we're responsible to protect the Torah. One of the ways of protecting the Torah is making rabbinic laws. Even though I've just now pointed out the first rabbinic law by Adam doesn't have very good consequences, and the second rabbinic law, which we can then say is a rabbinic law by Moshe, which adds another day, that maybe that also had all kinds of terrible consequences to it. Okay, so let's pause right there for a moment, keep all that in mind, push that on aside for a moment. We have a tradition that the accepting of the Torah was not necessarily 100% enthusiastic, or wasn't enthusiastically accepted. Why do I say that? It's a passage in the Talmud. The Talmud says that when God gave the Torah to the Jews, it was as if he held a mountain over their heads and says, either accept the Torah or, anyone remember what the next line is? He says, accept the Torah or what? The mountain will fall on you. He actually continues and he says, if not, Sham tiyek v'retchem. There will be your graves. By the way, sometimes you have to be real careful with rabbinic teachings. It should have said, here will be your graves. Po. Kan. It doesn't. It says Sham. What the Sham is not clear. Now let me go back to a point of law. If somebody tries to force you to do something against your will, especially financially, somebody puts a gun to your head and says, sell me this, you know, now you can fill in whatever, however you want to fill in the rest of the sentence, sell me this or I'm going to do this and this to you. Is the sale a good sale? Well, by the way, if it's not a good sale, then anybody has the ability after to say, listen, I was under duress. So there's a thing which is called a protest. I can go and tell witnesses, or I can write a contract and have witnesses affix it and say that this was done under protest. The rabbis say that God forced us to accept the Torah. There's no bigger protest against it. We should not be responsible. But by the way, you want me to save anybody who sins? Stand up to God and say, we did not accept the Torah willingly. You forced us to accept it. We never signed on for this. You made us do it. That's an unbelievable protest that we have against the acceptance of the Torah. The Gemara then continues and says, but they came back and they accepted it during the time of what we consider the time of Achashverosh, the time of Purim. That's when they accepted the Torah. By the way, this is a completely bizarre teaching, but this teaching is very important for us to understand all the connections that I want to try to get to today. When the Torah itself is accepted or given under conditions where there are so many blatant miracles, splitting of the sea, 10 plagues, revelation, we have no choice but to accept it. The story of Purim is a story where God's name does not appear even once in the book. It's a story where God does not seem to be a part of the story. And nonetheless, we're told that something profound happened right then. And that's part of what we need to understand now, what it is that happened. I don't know about Rabbi El-Ghazi. I know that almost every time there's a bar or bar mitzvah in my shul, I somehow get to the same point. I say it again and again and again. What's the purpose of education? The purpose of education is for the child to get to a point that they do what their parents want them to do, even though the parents aren't watching them, where the parents have internalized the value system of the parents. What's the job of a rabbi? Listen very carefully. What's the job of a rabbi, somebody who teaches in yeshiva? Right? What's the job of a rebbe? The job of a rebbe is to make the student self-sufficient that doesn't need the rebbe anymore. When the student can sit there and say, what question would my teacher have asked? That's very good. When he can then say, now what answer would he have said? What approach would he have taken? When he can do that, that point is independent. And at that point, the teacher has accepted, has succeeded. That's the point of education. when we accepted the Torah and said, Na'aseh v'nishma, what does Na'aseh v'nishma mean? Na'aseh is, we will do it. What does nishma mean? Well, Shem, we will listen. What does that mean, we'll listen? How can you do it if you didn't hear it yet? Na'aseh means we will do what it says in the Torah. What does v'nishma mean? And the first key or hint to this is, what, if you know Hebrew,
Yishmael, God listens, God hears.
V'nishma, that's very good. Mm-hmm. No, by the way, Na'aseh and Nishma are connected to Esav and to Yishmael. Okay? Actually, when we made the broken, when we made the golden calf, we ended up messing up, but I'm not sure how far I want to go in to explain that particular point, but correct. What is the, what I'm asking is in Hebrew, what tense is it? When we say Na'aseh is present, V'nishma. Nishma is present, moving towards future. Which means, what are we saying? We will continually listen. What are we saying as students to God? We will try to become the types of students who will be the successful ones that I described a moment ago, who will do what God wants us to do, even though when God is no longer speaking. At which point were we successful? At the point of Purim. Because God isn't speaking and we knew what to do. Which means the real acceptance of the Torah, or if you want me to put it differently, at which point did the Jewish people become bar or bar mitzvah? Which point? It was at the point of Purim when that happened, because at that point we became independent. At that point, but what does independent mean? Independent means you don't do what you want to do on your own. What does independent mean? Independent means now I've internalized what God wants of me, and I do what God wants of me, even though God isn't speaking. That's what the story of Purim is. Now let's go back and try to put some of this a little bit more into context. When Moshe goes up, and he's there for 40 days and 40 nights, when he comes down, the people are making a golden calf. And I can't begin to tell you how bad that is. The golden calf is not an independent sin. It is a colossal sin which has many, many parts to it. And don't worry, we're going to get to Purim very, very quickly. It has all kinds of sins to it. For example, there was a man named Hur. Before Moshe goes up the mountain, he says, if there's any issues, go to Hur, go to Aaron. They go to Hur, and what does Hur say? What's the matter? And they say, Moshe's not here, Moshe's gone. Let's make some kind of idol, some kind of god. Let's make a god to replace Moshe. Hur essentially says, over my dead body, they say, fine, they kill him. If you don't know who Hur is, when the Jews had a battle with Amalek, Hur holds up one hand of Moshe, and Aaron holds up the other hand. Aaron is the man who will become the Kohen Gadol. Hur comes from the tribe of Yehuda. His grandson builds the Mishkan. His grandson is Bezalel. A descendant of his will build the Beis HaMikdash. A descendant of his is going to be David HaMelech. A descendant of his is going to be Mashiach. Hur is the man who should have been king. Hur is the man who should have been the first king from the whole, what we call the Davidic dynasty, but this is way before then. They killed him. And they turn to Aaron, and they would have or they could have killed him as well. And Aaron does something fascinating. First thing he does, and there's no question in my mind about this, that he goes into a holding pattern. He says something which to me makes so much sense, and the only question is why it didn't work. What did he say? He said, sure, I'll make for you some kind of an idol, no problem. Bring all your wife's jewelry. I mean, tell your wife that you need the jewelry. I don't know who you're married to, but this should have been a no-brainer. I'm just saying, just basic. But nonetheless, it says that they all bring in immediately. And yet we have a tradition that the women didn't sin. The women were not involved in this, which means that the men went and stole the jewelry as well. Which means, other than making a golden calf, forget about God being mad at them. When they came home, they had hell to pay. Okay, just to understand, really, I told you, the sin of the golden calf has different aspects to it. That's something which I think should really be the most frightening aspect of it. Forget about that they killed Hur. Okay, so murder, idolatry. Actually, it says that the people achlu v'shatu v'kamal tzachek. They ate and they drank and they got up to party. Rashi over there says that an orgy broke out. Rashi says it was a sexual sins were going all over the place. What happened? This is at the foot of Mount Sinai. These are people who, again, they saw the sea split. They wake up every morning, the manna comes down from heaven. And these are the people that are sitting over there. By the way, just in case you think they did not have free will after all these things happened, they had free will. How do I know they free will? Because they used it. They used their free will. But to understand these sins, each one of these sins is terrible. Murder. I mean, to take a human life, any human life. And the Bible is very clear. The Torah is very clear in the opening chapters and says, all human beings are created in the image of God. To take a life in an unjustified way is something which is absolutely sacrilege. It's sacrilege to God. Take a human life. Take a human life like Chur is something which is absolutely unbelievable. They kill Chur. They make a golden calf. They have every single depraved sin imaginable, and that this, they're at Mount Sinai. Forget about, you know, some people can desecrate a synagogue. They're at Mount Sinai, and this happens. And Moshe, at the exact same time, is up in heaven, finishing touches on the Torah. He's about to bring it down. So you realize that there's something which is has gone terribly wrong at this particular point. As I said, every sin imaginable, all wrapped up in one, right there, on the one hand. And on the other hand, we find this holy place which has now been desecrated. Most of us don't realize the implications of what happened here. Rashi says it, but he doesn't say it here. He says it much later on. Rashi says that the 40 years in the desert are because of this, not because of the spies. He says they all got a suspended sentence at that point. It was 40 years. In fact, Rashi says the opposite is true. The reason the spies went for 40 days was to match the 40 years that they were already supposed to get. They had a suspended sentence, but once they sinned again, then they got the punishment back for the first time. Right? That's what Rashi teaches us. What's the implication of the 40 years? The implication of the 40 years is, first of all, well, I'll say it a nice way first. I'll say it in a very nice way. There's a whole argument that exists, this whole order of the Torah, at, right now at these particular sections. Was the sin of the golden calf before the instructions to build the Mishkan, or the instructions to build the Mishkan came first? What came? So there's some who think, okay, Rashi says that the golden calf came first. Some understand Rashi, had there not been a golden calf, there never would have been a Mishkan. Now that's true, but it's also not true.
Why is it not true?
First, do we want to know why it is true first? Or do you want to know which one you want? First, you have to explain why it's true. You know why it's true, so I'll tell you why it's not true. It's true because they would never have needed a Mishkan. But let me explain why not. The reason they wouldn't have needed a Mishkan is because they were supposed to go immediately from Mount Sinai to the land of Israel. The Mishkan is a temporary Mishkan. If they go straight to the land of Israel, you build the base of Mikdash immediately. If you build the base of Mikdash, you don't need a Mishkan. What should have happened at that point was Moshe comes down, and let's pause there for a second. What are the people doing when Moshe comes down? There's a party going on. They're eating and they're drinking and they're celebrating a total crazy rave, right? This is as good as it, well, it's not as good as it gets. It's as bad as it gets. But do you realize what holiday it was supposed to be right then? I mean, the Navi, Zechariah says that one day, this day, it's the 17th day of Tammuz. The Navi Zechariah says that the holiday of the fourth month of Tammuz will at some point become a holiday. What does it mean to become a holiday? Well, I'll tell you why it's been a holiday. Because it was supposed to be a holiday. The holiday it was supposed to be was Simchas Torah. Moshe comes down with the Torah. They're all supposed to be singing and dancing and eating and celebrating in front of the Torah. They made one little mistake. Instead of singing and dancing in front of Moshe, they're singing and dancing in front of the golden calf. Okay, it's a little mistake. I mean, some people thought Moshe had horns also, so you know you understand how they can make that little mistake. Because
you're getting that confused.
Which, about horns?
Yeah.
Oh, Moshe didn't have horns.
I mean, the carne, there's rays of
light. Ah, that's what it means. Okay, sorry.
No, I know. Actually, okay. You know, but
actually, Rashi says that the rays of light he had looked like horns.
Right.
Right, that actually did look far more like horns than you'd think, and the glow, Moshe looked far more like a golden calf than you ever would have imagined, because Moshe had a glow about him. So when I say again that there was a confusion, you thought I was kidding. I'm not kidding at all. But they did make a profound mistake. The profound mistake was to think that they can replace Moshe and just have a golden calf, and that's all that you need. So I'm saying that it was supposed to be Simchas Torah. That's really the important thing. But because it's not Simchas Torah, everything gets delayed. But how long does it get delayed? It ends up getting delayed to the point that Moshe will end up never going to the land of Israel. Moshe will never build the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash that Moshe could have built never would have been destroyed. All of that was sacrificed when they make this golden calf. So all this happens.
Today, right?
Today's the 7th of Adar, then yes. So now, what happens? What do we get because of this day? We end up getting Yom Kippur. How do we get Yom Kippur? Moshe goes up and he prays to God. He says, prays for forgiveness. Moshe ends up coming down with the second Luchot, the new tablets. When does he come down? He comes down on Yom Kippur. The Jews are forgiven on Yom Kippur. That's Yom Kippur the first year. Second year comes around, God gives a new instruction and says that we're going to do this every year. Now we're going to do Yom Kippur, and I want you to pay attention. What is it that we don't do in Yom Kippur? We don't eat, we don't drink, we don't have sexual relations and so on. All the things the Jews did in front of the golden calf, those are the things that we can't do in Yom Kippur. Because Yom Kippur is what's called a tikkun. It comes to fix the sin of the golden calf. So to get to see this directly. Now there's one thing which is very, very difficult. And the thing which is difficult is that the star of the day in Yom Kippur becomes Aaron. You say, how can Aaron be the star? Aaron was the star in terms of the golden calf. So I'm going to go back again. When he said, everybody give me the jewelry, he was trying to slow them down. Then the golden calf gets made, and he builds an altar. And he says, tomorrow's going to be a holiday for God. Tomorrow's going to be a holiday for God. Tomorrow is going to be a holiday, and he uses the Yudke Vavke. He knows exactly what he's talking about. Aaron apparently takes the opposite approach of Hur. Hur is active opposition, while Aaron joins in with them, and he goes about facilitating this. Aaron apparently is willing to sacrifice himself, his own soul, so the Jewish people don't do any more sins, including killing him. Not because he is concerned about himself, he's concerned about them. What I'm trying to explain is something which seems very strange. How in the world does Aaron become the Kohen Gadol? How does he become the star of the day on Yom Kippur? Yom Kippur is the day to bring forgiveness. Only somebody who's willing to sacrifice himself for the entire people, he's able to be the Kohen Gadol. So, what conclusions do we have so far? We have some kind of a rabbinic law, which is either good or bad, you can decide. We have that the Torah was forced upon us, and we really have a very good way to protest against this. What else do we have? We have the Jews did every possible sin there at the foot of Mount Sinai, which is obviously very, very unfortunate. We have the women don't sin. We have the men do sin. We have the person who becomes Kohen Gadol is Aaron, and he was involved in the whole sin. Okay. Many years later, this temple that we have doesn't really last. And I'll tell you why it doesn't last. It doesn't last because of the sin of the golden calf. That's why it doesn't last. Had there not been a sin for the golden calf, they would have gone straight to the land of Israel. Moshe would have let them in. Moshe would have built the Beis HaMikdash. Moshe's Beis HaMikdash would have been a completely, completely different book. It would have been a completely, completely different building. It would have been a building with a spiritual infrastructure which was so profound that it never possibly could have been destroyed. But instead, Moshe doesn't go in. Instead, they're in the desert another 40 years. Instead, what ends up happening is this Beis HaMikdash gets destroyed. And by the way, we don't realize it's so, right? But the Gemara and the Midrash stress the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash is actually an act of chesed on God's part. What I mean by chesed? It's kindness. Because God could have taken his wrath out on the Jewish people. And it says instead of taking his wrath out on the Jewish people, he takes his wrath out on a building. Actually, the phrase he uses, Eitzvah Oven. If you want to go back to Yishmael and Esav, the Vilna Gaon says, when it says that you're going to end up worshipping gods of Eitzvah Evan, he says Eitz represents the crucifix and Evan represents the mosque. But over here it says God took out his vengeance, his anger on the building, which means you realize what is the Beis HaMikdash about? It's a building that's supposed to, Jews supposed to bring offerings in order to get close to God. The building itself was sacrificed Just like Aaron was willing to sacrifice himself, here the building was sacrificed in order to save the people. People are saved, buildings destroyed, land of Israel destroyed, the people go into exile. Timing now is everything. A small group come back and start to build the second temple. 40,000 come back. They start. They stop. Why they stop, I'm not going to discuss now. They stop. What I do want you to hear very clearly is not enough of them were there. Not enough people came. And they couldn't continue, they stopped. Once they stop, the Jews become very, very vulnerable in other places. And this is the beginning of the story of Purim. Achashverosh, who's the king, he makes a party. What is his party about? His party is the celebration of the Beis HaMikdash not being built. It's a celebration that Judaism has come to an end. And you know the sickest part? And this shouldn't surprise us all that much. There are Jews who participated in the party. The Jews participating in the party in the beginning of the story in Megillah is just like the Jews sitting and eating and celebrating with the golden calf. It's the same type of sin. I don't know. I wasn't invited. But I'll take your word for it. The Jews were participating in this party, and that's something which is absolutely, absolutely outrageous. By the way, the Midrash tells us that there's one person who doesn't participate, and that one person, his name is Mordechai. Mordechai doesn't join the party. So, let's start to understand Mordechai, and we'll start to understand the party, and then we'll hopefully understand everything as we continue. The first time the people sinned, first time sin takes place, wasn't by the golden calf. Where was it? It was all the way back in the Garden of Eden. What happened in the Garden of Eden? Man begins to imagine that he can be like God. That was the selling point. The selling point by the serpent was, have this fruit and you can be like God. Isn't it interesting that by the golden calf they make a God? Oh, they think he can make a God. Again, if you have a real understanding of what God is, you can't make one. If you have a real understanding of what God is, you can't eat a fruit. It doesn't make a difference which fruit it is. It's not going to make you like God. In order to have these types of sins, you have to have a very diminished understanding of what you think God really is. The first sin begins all the way back by the Garden of Eden. We're told, matter of fact, the Gemara asks, Haman min HaTorah minayin? How do we know if such a person like Haman? He says, Amin ha'etz hazeh. Haman goes all the way back to that tree. He goes all the way back to the tree of knowledge of good and evil. The tree of knowledge of good and evil is a tree which brings about not knowledge. It's a tree that brings about knowledge of good and evil. What is good and evil together? Confusion. It's a tree that brings about confusion. The reality is that's a tree of death. You have death. You have two trees. Tree of life, and what's the other one? Okay, let's not call it a tree of death. One is a tree of life. If you eat it, you're going to live forever. And the other tree is, if you eat it, you're going to die. So I have a real simple question. Why not just call it the tree of death? What's the answer? Madison Avenue. Package. What's the term they'll use today? Branding. You need branding. You have to package it. So you call it something that sounds really good. This is a tree of knowledge of good and evil. Say, hold a second. Do I want knowledge of good and evil? Do I want knowledge of evil? Do I want knowledge confused with evil? Do I want confusion? But once knowledge sounds good, right? Knowledge sounded very good. Good sounds very good. Knowledge is good. Good is good. Good is knowledge. Knowledge is good. This is great. Except there's one problem. There's a tree of death. And when people eat from this tree, it's going to bring death into the world. Haman goes back to that, all the way back to that tree. Haman, in a sense, is like the Nachash. Haman is like the serpent. Haman is like the serpent who uses his words and he plots and he wants to kill man. Haman wants to kill man. The serpent wants to kill man. When the Gemara asks, where does Haman come from? He comes all the way back to that tree. That's the origin of Haman. Now, I want you to think deeply about this for a second. One of the great Hasidic masters, the B'nai Yisachar, writes that in the Garden of Eden, almost every sense was corrupted. Eve listens to what the serpent said, sees the tree, touches the tree, and eats the fruit. Only one sense was not corrupted, and that's the sense of smell. Okay, so there's one place of purity, that's the sense of smell. The Gemara then asks, Mordechai min HaTorah minayin? How do you ever know there would be a man like Mordechai? And it says, and quotes a verse, Mor Dror, this week's portion. Mor Dror. Mor Dror is a very, very good spice for incense. Mor Dror. By the way, if you want to look at it differently, Dror can mean freedom, and Mar can mean bitter, but that's not what it is. It's Mor Dror. It means the best type of incense. That's what it means. The best type of incense. So in Aramaic, Mordor is Mardechia, which sounds very much like Mordechai. The Gemara says, that's where Mordechai is. He says, what in the world is it talking about? You have to say it in Aramaic and whatever. By the way, once you have to say it in Aramaic, you know that something is hidden. There's something hidden about this. This is not something which everybody can see. So let's try to understand. Let's try to reveal what's hidden. By the way, the whole idea of Megillat Esther is the scroll of Esther. But Megillat Esther also is Legalot et Esther, to reveal that which is hidden. Megillat Esther is to reveal that's what's hidden. So let's reveal a little bit of what's hidden over here. Mor Dror is the incense. When the Kohen Gadol would go in on Yom Kippur into the inner sanctum, the Holy of Holies, what did he go in with? He went in with the incense, which means the incense is the way to bring about forgiveness. Why is the incense so powerful? Because that's the one thing that was never affected by smell, but by sin. The one sense that was not affected by sin. Back by sin. Was not affected by sin. The sense of smell was not affected by sin. So therefore, using the incense from the Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol, using this, it makes a great deal of sense. Now let's go back to Mordechai. Mordechai is the one person who doesn't participate in the party. Mordechai is the one person who doesn't bow down to Haman. Everyone else bows down. Why doesn't Mordechai bow down? So the Arizal explained that Mordechai comes from the tribe of Binyamin. When Yaakov leaves Lavan's house and he meets up with Esav, all of his sons and him all bow down to Esav. Only one person doesn't bow down. And who's that? That's Binyamin. Why doesn't he bow down? Because he wasn't born yet. Which means that everyone else at times will be subservient to Esav, except for Binyamin. He will not be subservient. So that's why it says, doesn't say Mordechai didn't bow down. It says he never will. Again, in the future, like I said before, Nishma. It says Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. Mordechai will never bow down. Why? Because Mordechai represents Binyamin. Binyamin is the one tribe that was not tainted by that particular sin. Mordechai will never bow down. But Mordechai is a little more than that. Mordechai is described in the beginning of the Megillah as Ish Yehudi Ayav B'Shushan Abira, and then his name is Mordechai ben Ir ben Kish, Ish Yemini. So hold it, what is he? Ish Yehudi or Ish Yemini? What's the difference in Yehudi versus Yemini? Yehudi means somebody from the tribe of Yehuda. Yemini means from the tribe of Binyamin. And the Gemara starts out, hold it, what is it? So it comes to all kinds of possible solutions. One, he's from the tribe of Yehuda, but he lived in Binyamin. One is he lived in Yehuda, but he's in the tribe of Binyamin. One is his mother's from Yehuda, his father's from Binyamin, his mother's from Binyamin, his father's from Yehuda. All kinds of possibilities, and I'm going to tell you something which I think maybe is a little deeper than everything else I just now said. Yehuda and Binyamin represent the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash was on the portion of Binyamin. The Holy of Holies was on the portion of Yehuda. Mordechai, therefore, represents that exact place, the meeting between Yehuda and Binyamin, and that's the point of the Beis HaMikdash, exactly where the Holy of Holies is.
I don't get that, because he's in Kush.
So I'll say it again. He's described as Ish Yehudi and Ish Yemini. What are his origins? Who is he? Yeah. Now, by the way, is Mordechai undercover? Of course he's undercover. Mordechai, the name Mordechai is very close to Persian god, right? Marduk,
right.
But we don't even realize what kind of a joke this is. When you hear Ish Yehudi, there's a Jewish guy. What is his name? Mordechai. What do you mean a Jewish name Mordechai? There's an absurdity there. By the way, Esther as well is connected with Ishtar. The whole thing is talking about what's undercover. What's undercover, Mordechai, is that he really represents, as I said, this one place where there's not sin. He's the one who doesn't bow down. He's the one who doesn't participate in the party. What is the background to the entire story? The destroyed Beis HaMikdash, which Ahasuerus believes will never be rebuilt. What does Mordechai represent? He represents the Beis HaMikdash. Here you have the exact issue. What does Mordechai represent? He represents the incense. The incense is what was used on Yom Kippur in the Beis HaMikdash. So now you begin to see that things are not as simple as they look beforehand. Let's take a 5-minute, not break, you're not getting a break. Let's take a 5-minute understanding of the book of Esther, and then we'll try to make everything fit in and everything clear and everything understood. The book begins with a king celebrating. According to rabbinic tradition, Ahasuerus was not from royalty. Notice what's missing when it describes him. Mordechai is described as Mordechai, right? Ben Yair, Ben Kish, Ishimini. Ahasuerus is just Vayihi, Bimei Ahasuerus. Doesn't say his father's name, doesn't say his grandfather's name, doesn't say anything else. What's missing there? Lineage. Why is lineage missing? Because he doesn't have any. As a matter of fact, the Gemara tells us that, you know how close he was to royalty? He is the one who worked in the stable of the old king. So here's the first scene. This is not in the Megillah, by the way. I'm making this up. Here's the first scene. When we make a movie out of it, here's the first scene. Ahasuerus is a young man, maybe even a boy, teenager. He's in the stable. What do you do in the stable? He's cleaning out the stuff that you clean out from the stable. You all know what it is. He's cleaning this out, and there's a window there. Through the window, a ray of light comes in. He looks out the window, and he sees up the palace is right there in the background. In the palace on the third floor, there's a beautiful girl who's standing on the balcony on the third floor in the palace, and she's brushing her hair. Who is she? She's Vashti. And he looks up, and he says, one day she'll be mine. Well, who's she? Who's she?
Daughter
of the king, and the palace, and the kingdom. One day she'll be mine, referring to all of this. But who is he? He's a stable boy. He's a stable boy. And by the way, every word was right. He succeeds, he has a coup, he ends up taking over everything, and what's his, he has a trophy. I tell you, when my wife, she's my trophy wife. Okay, trophy wife, my only wife for 30 years, but I still, this is a trophy wife. Vashti's a trophy wife. Only one problem is, what's the problem? In order to become king, he killed her whole family. He's had to rape her to have her. They're sitting at, here's another scene I'm making up if you like. They're sitting together at dinner, long, long, long table. He's at one end, she's at the other end. She has silverware, he doesn't. She has a little piece of food, but she's got no appetite. He picks up a leg of lamb in his hand and he's munching at it, and she says, you are an unbelievable pig. And he says, what? She says, nothing. She hates him. He makes a big party. Why does he make a big party? And he invites everyone to the party. Why does he invite everyone to the party? Because he didn't grow up as king. He is very, very insecure. He wants everyone to love him. He wants everyone to be his friend. Everybody come to the party. Everybody drink. But he wants to show off what he has. What's the biggest prize that he has? The biggest prize that he has is Vashti. By the way, Vashti also has a party. She's also drinking. People drink for different reasons. Vashti is drinking with the other women who were all vanquished, the other women who were all taken, the other women whose families were killed. And they're sitting and drinking. They're drinking out of sorrow. They're drinking to forget their miserable lives. And he then comes and says, come in, come in. I want to show her. I want to show you off. And what does she say? She says, drop dead and go to hell. And you know what? By the way, it never says that he kills her. Go read the book again as many times as you want. It never says that he kills her. He doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know what to do. Because she's his prize. What can she do? And she's the one who gives him legitimacy. What's he going to do? On the other hand, by the way, if you go and look at some of the literature on the book of Esther, there are those who claim, by the way, not rabbis, there are those who claim that Vashti's the real hero because Vashti's a real feminist. Because they're real, right? And because Vashti gets killed. No. Vashti's the real feminist because Esther is such a loser. Esther does what everyone asks her to do, but Vashti, she's the one. After Vashti is gone, he needs to replace her. So he makes a whole big, by the way, it's not a beauty contest. Beauty contests are sexist. The fact that beauty contests exists in the 21st century shows how primitive we still are. It's absolutely unbelievable. It's something which, if society can't figure out how this kind of thing should be stopped, it just absolutely eludes me. But as bad as a beauty contest, this isn't a beauty contest. The rules are very, very clear. He collects all the young women together. He sleeps with every one of them. If you lose the contest, you stay in his harem for the rest of your life. If you win the contest, you become his queen. There's no contest over here. This is just a way of him collecting a lot of women for his harem. This is a win-win as far as he's concerned. It's a lose-lose as far as they're concerned. Except a lot of women said, you know what, live in a harem is a good deal. Get three meals a day, get taken care of, get jewelry, get anything else I need. A lot of women want to be in it. A nice Jewish girl gets dragged into this. She doesn't want to win it. She doesn't want to be that. She's passive. She's taken. She's against her will. Mordechai tells her you have to do it. So she does it. She doesn't ask for anything. She doesn't ask for makeup. She doesn't ask for perfume. All the other women ask for all these things. She doesn't ask for anything. Why doesn't she ask for anything? Okay, because she's playing hard to get. Why does Esther play hard to get? This is very difficult. None of you can understand this. Why does Esther play hard to get? Because she is hard to get. That's exactly okay. She's not playing. This is exactly the issue.
She doesn't want anyone to say that she was a willing participant.
Yeah, she doesn't want this. By the way, you realize the biggest question that nobody ever asks? The biggest question is, why didn't she just give up her life like Vashti did? I mean, once you realize that's what Vashti was doing, this was her protest. Why doesn't Esther do the exact same thing? Esther is a Vashti replacement. Why doesn't she do the same thing? Mordechai says, who knows? Maybe that's the spark of some kind of understanding of God's hand in history. And she participates. Now think a second. Why does Esther win? Esther wins. All the other women are very enthusiastic. All the women have too much perfume and too much makeup. Why does Esther win? Because she is so distant and she's so cold. And she is so, and you know what?
Intriguing.
But she reminds Ahasuerus of Vashti. There's something aristocratic about it. All the other women are throwing themselves at him. Okay. What do men want? Among other things. What do men want? What they can't have. All the other women are easy. Okay, good. You're in the harem. Great. But her, she's much more difficult. That's the whole starting point of the story. I said 5 minutes, so now we have another 2 minutes to end the story. What happens? Haman, who's a lunatic. Okay, Ahasuerus is absolutely paranoid. Why is Ahasuerus paranoid? It's all the way through the story. Why is he paranoid? That's the curse that he endures because he took the government by force. So he's always worried that there's some other stable boy or somebody in the kitchen or somebody else who's now plotting to take over. Every place that he looks, he sees somebody who may have a coup. He's totally tortured by it. Why? Because he already did it. He knows there must be somebody else after him. And you know what the best part is? There are people after him, as we know, Big Ten Viteresh. There are people plotting to get rid of him. But he sees plots all over the place, completely, completely paranoid. Okay? Keep that in mind. Haman, total lunatic. He is, I can't prove everything right now, but he happens to be bipolar. It's not my fault, he is. He happens to be bipolar. He's also a complete megalomaniac. Everyone's got to bow down to him. Everybody to this. One guy doesn't bow down to him. The whole war. But by the way, that's where you actually see this absolutely extreme behavior. I don't want to get ahead of myself. Hold on to that for a second. Haman, there's one man who won't bow down to him. He goes nuts. That's it. Why just kill one Jew? Let's kill all the Jews. Let's get rid of all of them. By the way, that's victory. No more Jews left. He won. Esther finds out about it. Mordechai says, you better do something. So what does she do? And her plan is so simple, and her plan is so elegant. What does she do? Well, first she has one problem, and it's this one problem we're going to come back to. What's the one problem she has? The king is paranoid, and therefore you can't go see the king without him inviting you. If you go to see him without inviting you, then you may get killed. That's a problem. So she says, okay, I'm going to go. By the way, what's worse comes to worse, she gets killed. Okay, next. But she says, I'll try. But for her to go in and see the king now, it's not so simple. How does she have to go to see the king? She has to now go and smile at him, and she has to laugh at his silly jokes, and she has to go and try to seduce him. Which is, Esther now has to become a very, very different Esther. And she does. At this point, there's a change. But she comes up with a plan, which is so brilliant, which it's amazing that not everybody teaches it exactly the way that I'm going to explain it to you. What is her plan? She knows that Ahasuerus is paranoid, and she knows that Haman is a megalomaniac, so she just pits one against the other. She goes into Ahasuerus, and she smiles, and she bats her eyelashes, and she flirts with him, and she put on makeup this time, and she's trying. And what does Ahasuerus say? Now again, he's not a simple character. What does he say? On the one hand, he says to himself, is something going on? On the other hand, he said, okay, she finally came around. Okay, she wants a little bit of this. Okay, so fine. But she walks in and she says, he says, what do you want? If you mean anything to me, I want you to come by tonight. That's it. By the way, men are not complicated characters. I don't know why they have to be 50 shades of gray. You only need one. Men are not so complicated. She comes, says, I want to see you tonight. That's it. But then she adds in one little thing. What does she say? Bring that Haman guy with you also. At that point, when you have a guy who's paranoid, that drives him crazy. They both come over tonight. What do you want? But by the way, Haman should have been very careful at this point. A better politician would have said, what in the world is going on? Why is she inviting me? What is she doing? Who is she? What does she want? Instead, what does he say? Yeah, of course they want me. So Ahasuerus's paranoia is going nuts. Haman's megalomania is getting out of control. She says, you know what? You wonder what I want? Well, you come by tomorrow night again. Okay, so now, Haman is flying high, but then he sees Mordechai, and he shoots all the way down low. He says, everything I have is worthless. That's why I'm saying. He goes very high, he goes very, very low. Ahasuerus, did her plan work? Ahasuerus is lying in bed that night. He can't sleep. Why can't he sleep? Because something's going on. Haman, he comes up with a great plan. Let's kill the one guy who tried to protect the king. I mean, that's a wonderful plan. What does he do? In the middle of the night, a king who's scared, who doesn't want anybody to come without being invited, he knocks on the door in the middle of the night. You hear the fear in Ahasuerus. Who's there? Who's outside? Here's a man who's terrified. So what does he say? He says the stupidest thing you can possibly say to a king. Right? The king tests him and says, if somebody did something nice for the king, what should he do? So what's the stupidest thing you can say? Give him the king's clothing, give him the king's crown, give him the king's horse, give him the king's everything, and let him ride around and say, this is how you treat the king. And you know what's really great? I don't know if any of you got it. He says, fine, you do all this, but you lead the horse around. What's he telling Haman who he really is? Stable. You're a stable boy. He just now threw Haman right back to the stable where Ahasuerus himself had come from in the beginning. By the way, the truth is the story's over at that point. Everything else is going to be details. I want to return to one issue. I want to return to our nice Jewish girl named Esther who went inside and had to go and work her wiles on this king. At that moment, all of us can say, hold it, there's something terribly wrong over here. So now I want to go back to the title of the class. The title was something to the effect about Yom Kippur and Purim, which I've already talked a little about Yom Kippur and Purim, but I want to say it a lot, lot sharper now. There's a passage in the Zohar that says that when the Kohen Gadol goes in to the Holy of Holies, do you want me to read it? You want to actually hear the source? You think I'm making it up, right? Okay. It says that when the Kohen Gadol would go into the Holy of Holies, it says he would put on holy royal garb. This is in Tikkuni Zohar on page 57b. V'iyu Yom Kippurim, on Yom Kippur, v'kad it kashatit kadme b'levushin shafirin. On that day, the Kohen Gadol would go in with beautiful clothing. What makes the clothing beautiful? What makes them beautiful? De'inan levushe kapara, because they're clothing of forgiveness. That's what makes it beautiful. It carried tzitz delay, mitzefet delay, avnit delay, and it goes through the various things, the various parts of the clothing. Iu kalila ba'arvigde lovan, together with the four different garments of white, he would go into the Holy of Holies with only clothing of white. The white, it says, that this is clothing which is called from the right side, and the four clothing of gold that he did not go inside with, which is called the clothing on the left side. But whose manad it kashta b'ilan, and when he put on these clothing, levushin de kapara, when he put on these particular clothings of kapara, itmaba, what verse applies to the Kohen Gadol when he went in like this? And the verse is what's shocking. The verse that the Zohar quotes is Vatilbosh Esther Malchut. Esther put on royal clothing. What does Esther have to do with the Kohen Gadol? It then says Vahudila Lufnai Vilufnim, and then he would go into the inner sanctum, Hadhu Dichtiv, and that's what the verse says, Vatamud Bachatzer Beit HaMelech HaPinimit. And the Kohen Gadol going into the inner room, that's like Esther going into the middle room. By the way, right afterwards is where the famous teaching comes from, and it says, and that's why Purim is connected to Yom Kippur. That Yom Kippurim, that's the, by the way, in the Torah, it's never called Yom Kippur. It's always called Yom Kippurim, a day of forgiveness. So the Zohar here says that Purim and Yom Kippurim are very similar. And you're going to all say to me, Purim and Yom Kippur are very similar? What are you talking about? On Yom Kippur, we fast. On Purim, we celebrate. So I want to say it again. Where did Yom Kippur come from? Yom Kippur came from? It came from fixing the golden calf. There we ate and we drank and we celebrated. What happens in Kippur? We don't eat, don't do any celebration. What do we do on Purim? On Purim we eat and we drink and we celebrate. Purim is a day that we serve God the way we were supposed to serve God, all the way back when we made a little mistake, and that was the golden calf. And that's why I said the beginning of the story is like the beginning of the story of the golden calf. Which means, very good. So the day before Yom Kippur is the day that we're supposed to eat, and then the next day we fast. The day before Purim is the day that we fast, and the next day that we celebrate. So we see that, in a sense, these days are the inverse of one another. And by the way, part of the reason we need to fast, and it's a mystery. You know, the Tanis Esther is a mystery, where it came from and what it's about. But I sense that one of the reasons we fast is because of Esther, and is because of a life and the difficult situation that she was in. But let me just explain this last bit. Again, what the Zohar is saying. I'm not putting any words in. The Zohar said when the Kohen Gadol goes in, it's like Esther putting on the royal clothing. And it says that when she goes into the inner sanctum. Now keep in mind, the Talmud teaches us that whenever it says the word the king in Megillas Esther, it always refers to God. It says Esther says, I can't go and see the king, right? Because if anybody goes in without, they're not supposed to be there, they'll die. She starts describing the inner sanctum of seeing the king the same way that our sources explain the inner sanctum in the Beis HaMikdash. You make one mistake and you're dead. On Yom Kippur, all the hopes and aspirations and prayers of all the people are based on what the Kohen Gadol is going to do. The Zohar is telling us something which is unbelievable. It's telling us that Esther walking in to see the king, that we can look at it, and maybe it'll be a little cynical. She put on makeup and she was flirting and she was smiling and who knows what she had to do. And the Zohar is telling us, you don't understand, that when Esther walked in, she walked in with the same exact kavana, intention, holiness, as the Kohen Gadol does in Yom Kippur. And that's what I wanted to say. This is an ancient, postmodern understanding of what heroism is. This understanding that Esther is the hero, but the heroism of Esther is, don't think for a second that there's a sin involved or whatever. And then in a sense, this is the exact inverse of what went on by the golden calf. But Esther over here is in the role of Aaron. You can say Aaron sinned, and that's why he became Kohen Gadol. You can say Esther sinned, if you want. You can say that she sinned, but she saved the entire nation. Just like Aaron saved the entire nation, she saved the entire nation. And what the Zohar is teaching, and therefore, when Esther put on that clothing, don't be cynical and say, she put on a short skirt and she put on this. No. She put on holy clothing. She went on to function as the Kohen Gadol. You want to know what was deep inside her heart? Deep inside her heart was one thing: how do I save this people? And the Zohar, what it's calling her the Kohen Gadol. By the way, it did everything but actually use that phrase. It says, but when the Kohen Gadol goes in, he puts on her holy clothing, just like Esther. And when the Kohen Gadol goes into the inner place, he goes to the inner place, just like Esther. Which means it's the other way around. It's Yom Kippurim. Yom Kippur is not the holy day. Purim's the holy day. The Kohen Gadol isn't the holy person. He's like Esther. She's the one who's holy. Which means any Kohen Gadol who wants to function, what he needs in his heart is the same kind of kavana that Esther had. That's what this is teaching us. Which means the story of Purim is a story when we did create a new rabbinic holiday. This is a whole new thing. It's a rabbinic holiday. God isn't here. God isn't telling. Here we went and we said, well, what would God want us to do? Esther says, what would God want me to do? Mordechai says, what would God want me to do? And what God wanted her to do was to save the people. And what God wanted Mordechai and Esther to do was to create a new holiday. And here you see the power of rabbinic law. A couple months ago, one of my students said, I like the Torah law, I don't like the rabbi's law. I said, you don't like Hanukkah? You don't like that one? I like. You don't like Purim? No, I like that one also. I said, you know what? I think you like the rabbinic laws. It's just like, maybe some of them you don't understand yet. The ones you understand, you seem to like them. This is when the Jews became a bar and bar mitzvah. This is when the Jews grew up. This is when the Jews became independent. Here the Jews knew exactly what they were supposed to do, even though God isn't speaking to them anymore. And that is why we celebrate Purim. On the other hand, I agree. We can't get to the celebration of Purim without remembering the incredible difficult life that this young orphan girl named Esther had. By the way, one more secret, and then we'll finish. Esther's real name wasn't Esther. Her real name was Hadassah. Hadassah is the part of the four species that has a beautiful smell. That means Esther really was the Ketores. Esther really was the Ketores, the incense that you bring into the Holy of Holies. Not only did Esther function as the Kohen Gadol, she actually, in terms of her real essence, is the Ketores. And therefore, what Esther did is bring about forgiveness for the entire Jewish people. We should all merit to celebrate Purim the way that we're supposed to. And if we do that, maybe we will have a step towards actually getting the Kohen Gadol back and getting the third base of Migdash. Thank you very much.